So when I first heard, actually from you, that eating fatty meat is optimal and a meat-based diet is the best way to live, I actually was, I think, pretty open to it. And I started it almost immediately and saw pretty immense benefits. But the funny thing is that when I tried to share this with my friends and family, really, I got so much pushback and a bit of a backlash. And at the time, we weren't married and we had just started talking about it. Did you feel that I was resistant, or did I do any kind of pushback on the idea?
No, I think it made sense to you, so you wanted to try it and to see the results on you.
What was the thing that you believe you normally say to people that keeps them a little bit more open? Because I think we're indoctrinated. I think we're definitely conditioned to believe that fatty meat is heavy, it's unhealthy for us, and anything plant-based is always more natural and better for you. So how do you overcome these years of conditioning? To get people to be just open enough to understand that there could be something very beneficial for us to learn here.
So I would say that it depends. Each person is different and driven by, let's say, different preconceived ideas. Myself, 7 years ago, I would have had no clue on how important diet was. I could eat anything without any consequence. But I lost a dear friend to metabolic disease, and when he passed away, I really took it hard to try to understand what happened. I discovered with horror the current state of affairs in health in humans in our period, and everyone knows that what we call diseases of civilization are exploding. It's an exponential trend. Heart disease, diabetes, hypertension, even mentally, many people are depressed. There's autism cases that go to the roof, and all of this can be, I think, boiled down to metabolic problems and even cancer. There's a strong argument to be made that cancer is not a genetic anomaly, it's a metabolic problem.
And how did you make that correlation to now the meat-based diet that you're a proponent of?
Yes, so the Hippocratic Oath states that food is your first medicine, Hippocrates.
And all doctors are meant to take the Hippocratic Oath.
Yes.
Do they still do that? Do they
Yes,
still take the oath?
sure.
But yet, none of them. I have so many cousins and friends that are doctors, and I've asked them all, how much does food play into your into the in factor into you treating your patients? And they've pretty much told me across the board that they're actually not even allowed to talk about food with their patients. So they're not allowed to see if their patients are eating too much sugar or junk food or any type of food. So how is it that they can take the oath and yet not factor food into their treatment for their patients?
Well, they are, let's say, educated in a system that makes us believe that any bettering of our health, if it goes bad, has to come from an external help and that the body is basically helpless. And we forget that, I mean, just like a car is running on a certain fuel appropriate to its engine, if we put in our bodies foods that are not appropriate to the way it functions, we will run into trouble.
And yet the doctors don't.
They don't believe really that because
Why?
they are operating into, so you have two possibilities. The body is working until it doesn't, for whatever reason. It can even go into autoimmune problems, meaning that suddenly, for reasons we don't know, it attacks itself on certain grounds. This is one possibility, that suddenly, let's put it that way, the body becomes crazy. And so you need to help it by pills, by
That's what the
medication.
doctor's
Yeah,
approach would be.
this is the approach, the modern medicine approach. Something goes wrong, they can call it genetic, but genetic is more and more a buzzword.
It's a cover-up, really.
Yeah, it means I really don't know. I can identify things that I judge abnormal, but we know with epigenetics, that the pure genetic code is just a potential that is expressed or not through epigenetics, through the environment factors and the way we live. So the second possibility is that the body is working perfectly, and if it stops working perfectly, then it means that it is poisoned in a way or malnourished. So the first thing to do would be to make sure that we give this body all the means necessary to operate correctly.
And for doctors, that tends to be more in the way of pharmaceuticals and meds than food and lifestyle.
Yeah. And
because why?
It's the way they are educated. You know, my father is a neuropsychiatrist, and when I pointed, he's retired now. When I pointed to him that 100% of mental ill patients had gastric problems or digestion problem, or, you know, the digestive tract had issues, he said, it's true. And when I asked him, how many times in your practice, I mean, he probably was a neuropsychiatrist for 50 years, how many times did you ask one of your patients what this patient ate? He looked at me and he said, never. I said, well, there is a strong link between digestion and mental health.
But he agreed with that.
Yeah. But he never
considered it.
Put this into practice in his clinical practice, you know?
Yeah, that's remarkable. And maybe because the push by the pharmas is so strong, which obviously indicates a conflict of interest too, right? Because if the pharmaceuticals are pushing their product, there is no interest in food.
Well,
from that perspective,
to put it extremely, the cure needs to generate some revenue to someone.
Yeah.
So you cannot patent a good diet, especially if it's a natural diet.
Well, you introduced me to the work of Dr. Anthony Chaffee, and I really encourage a lot of people to actually follow him. He's on a couple of platforms, and he's got a podcast and a YouTube channel. And he talks about this challenge, that because doctors and the medical industry in general and science doesn't make money off of people benefiting from the meat-based diet, they genuinely just don't want to really bring any light to it. They don't want to necessarily inform people about the benefits of it.
I would say then they could. I work with doctors who adopted personally this way of eating because they saw the results on themselves, but they cannot talk about it to their patients because they would lose their medical license.
That's, to me, just really sad.
Yes, it is.
One of the latest podcasts that actually you and I heard together that you introduced me to of Anthony Chaffee was where he's interviewing Sophia Clemens, who runs a clinic in Hungary, in which they pretty much have helped people cured, put people into remission on very serious conditions just by fatty red meat alone. And she says that there's a huge challenge there because it's so simple, the approach, and it's very hard for people to believe that that's all that's required. Let me just play a clip and maybe you can comment on this.
It is a very specific protocol. So actually there's only one perfect diet, one therapeutic diet. There are no more.
When she says it's a very specific protocol and there's only one diet, there's no more than one diet. I believe that now, but I came from the mindset that everybody's different and therefore different people have different needs and there's different ways to approach their problems. You taught me otherwise, Ahmed. You taught me that, no, we're all the same and everyone can benefit from eating fatty red meat, which was shocking to me, I have to admit, and pretty much just a meat-based diet, which is what she's a proponent of in her clinic. Where did we get that thought from, that we're all different and we all should have different approaches to our diet for different reasons?
I think it's a gross exaggeration. We are all different, for sure. But metabolically, from a molecular biology perspective, our digestive system, the way our enzymes work, etc., we are exactly the same species. And Dr. Chaffee pointed out that just try to find one exception within a species of an animal who has a diet that is different to all the other members of the species. It doesn't exist. And humans, we are the only ones who have been driven by, let's say, economic interest. And we are driven by ideas. The idea of the benefits for our health of a plant-based diet, or mostly plants. I think today the standard American diet is probably around 70-80% plant-based, so we are already mostly plant-based. This idea was put out there forcefully by the food pyramid that was put together by the Ministry of Agriculture in order to maximize the output of plant production, of crop production. Before that, plants were like a default diet. In the Middle Age, we have a lot of testimonials of people, peasants, and even noble people who were complaining about the unavailability of meat, and they had to fall back into these crops, etc., who were just a small part of their diet, but when it reached more than 50%, it becomes a poverty diet.
And it starts making us sick. Can you just, in a nutshell, tell us what is the problem with plants? Why is it dangerous? And Dr. Anshin Chafee actually says that plants will kill you. He's very adamant that we understand the dangers of eating anything plant-based. Yeah. Can you explain to us in a nutshell why they're dangerous and why we shouldn't eat them?
So I wouldn't say that we shouldn't eat them. Mm-hmm. I would say that basing a whole food and nutrition on them is deleterious, because plants, they contain macronutrients, very little fat in general, a lot of sugar, and proteins, yes, but mostly not complete for our needs, and much less bioavailable. So this is an inferior food, and this is a food that we can use as a side when we are metabolically healthy, and when these plants have not been, let's say, transformed by the human hand, like most of the plants we have today available, have been engineered by humans over the past 1,000 years, you know. So this is one thing. The plants do not contain all the nutrients we need as humans to thrive. We are missing a lot of vitamins and minerals from the plants. And there is, on top of this, the hard truth that plants are living creatures. They do not want to be eaten by animals.
Yeah.
And an animal can defend itself mm-hmm. through fighting or through fleeing, but a plant cannot move, and they are genius in chemical warfare. So when we put insecticides and pesticides on crops, on land, in order to grow our crops, these pesticides and insecticides we have not invented ourselves. We have found them in plants.
They're naturally inside the plants.
Yes, they are natural toxins that plants use to kill insects and to kill animals want to eat them.
So even something that's really clean grown with no external chemicals or pesticides or whatnot can be equally dangerous or just as dangerous. I read something about lectins and the celluloids that make them anti-nutrients. Is that correct?
So in general, there's a whole category of chemicals called anti-nutrients. These are the defense mechanisms of the plant. You have a lot of them.
And they hurt us if we ingest them.
They are meant to hurt the predator that eats parts of the plant that the plant considers is to be protected. So they are everywhere in all plants except in ripe fruit.
Okay.
Because the fruit is produced by the plant in order to be eaten by animals mm-hmm. so that the seeds would be squatted further.
So are fruits okay to eat then?
Fruits, the problem today is that they are much richer in, sugar than they used to be.
Fructose.
Fructose in particular. And when we are eating, in the past, fruits would be eaten in season and they would not be available all the time. Now we have an access to fruit all the time mm-hmm. and all fruits from all over the world all the time. and we are simply overloading our system with sugar.
And Sally Norton's work, which is another expert that you introduced me to, talks about oxalates in fruits and vegetables, mm-hmm. which are very damaging to our body, which is also a new area for me. I never understood this. And when I did, I was actually floored how much damage we're causing to our body and the beauty aspect of it, because from her work, I learned that it actually makes your skin sag. Oxalates are not good for the skin, as opposed to anything meat-based, which obviously gives you a boost of collagen, depending on what part of the meat that you eat, tends to tighten your skin. So just from that aspect, I found that to be interesting. And I know that you and I like to, being Muslims and being very committed to a faith-based lifestyle, we really do try to cross-reference everything that we learn about life and living with, you know, what we're taught in the Quran and through our faith. And this thing that you talked about, plants being an inferior food, can actually be checked out in the second chapter, Surah Baqarah, verse 61. Is that correct? Where, what is that exactly that we're told in Surah 2, verse 61?
Yes. So when I started this investigation on metabolism, I came up to the conclusion that the species appropriate diet for humans, for many reasons, evolutionary. So for the past 2 million years, we've been eating meat. We are a kind of primate that is in a niche. We have developed big brains and very short digestive systems jointly that sets us apart from all other primates. It's not something unheard of in the evolution animals. For example, you have turtles. You know, they look like regular turtles, and you have all this image of a turtle eating salad, but you have turtles that are actually carnivores. Mm. Okay, so within the same, let's say, shape or whatever, you can have different possibilities.
And Surah Baqarah, verse 61, so talks about...
Yes, and so I started to investigate this question. So evolutionary, even biologically, you reach a conclusion that red meat with associated fat is the perfect diet for humans, as humans being carnivorous animals and having thrives on these big ruminant animals. That now, as a Muslim, you are kind of worried because you have this idea also that plants are so good for us, and you've read the Quran
and some hadith
and some claims about the medicine of the Prophet that mm-hmm. is. They want to make Sayyidina Nabi almost a vegetarian.
Right.
All right. So if you go back to the Quran itself, you find that Allah in his book addresses two kind of food for humans, meat and fruits. All the rest is not mentioned or mentioned in a negative way, as it is in the second surah,
that
is
called
verse 61, where the people of Israel in the desert are nourished miraculously every day by Allah with meat, which is salwa, manna. Manna is a substance that is quite mysterious, but we can try to investigate what it is. And they get fed up with eating the same thing every day.
What is manna? Sorry.
Manna, my conclusion, is fat.
Ah, okay. So meat and fat.
Yes, which is just perfect for humans.
Okay.
And
the verse talks about plants.
Yes, and these people are demanding variety in their diet, and they ask for everything that is grown from the earth in terms of plants. You have five words that probably represent categories of plants, like the root, you know, the greens, etc. And when they ask for that, Sayyidina Musa answers to them that why are they willing to replace what is superior,
the meat,
by what is inferior,
the plants. Wow.
And
that's actually in the scripture, which was enlightening for me, because I had never noticed it until you pointed it out. So again, coming back to the clinic in Hungary that Sophia Clemens runs, they talk about, to really tackle a condition, a disease, an illness, you really must be strict. And allowances is discouraged, but obviously if you're weak, she accepts it. Let me just play something for you.
You can hear that if you have a histamine issue, then you need a histamine intolerance diet, or if you are insulin resistant, then you need an insulin resistance diet. But actually, I believe that there is only one therapeutic diet, and you should apply this very strict, very fine-tuned diet if you come across any severe chronic conditions. And you can do allowances right at the beginning or later on, but this is the allowance part of the protocol. It may not add anything. It may not add any benefit. It is just more doable for some patients.
So if I'm allowing a little bit of cheating, let's say someone is really trying to focus on a serious illness, and according to her, focus on the high fat and red meat intake. If I did sort of let in a few plant-based items here and there in my diet, would that set me back if I'm really working towards fixing a condition?
These plants contain so many molecules that we don't even know about, these phytonutrients, etc., that you don't want to take a risk. What we notice, and doctors who practice dietary interventions around the carnivorous diet, which is the proper species appropriate diet for humans, they notice that some people, as soon as they reintroduce any kind of plant, they just set back. So
you set back meaning that we have to start again with the treatment if we start messing around with adding plants?
Yeah, in general, if you eat something that is inappropriate, that creates something you react to, the reaction can come immediately or it can come within 3 days. And in order for this effect to clear out, it can clear out pretty in a few days, or it can take up to 3 weeks.
Right.
So when you are metabolically sick and you want really to address and get an optimal health, don't do any exception. Even a simple bit of pepper can really, let's say a 5% exception or 2% exception can make you lose 50% of the benefits.
So let's listen to a little bit more about what she said, because it gets more and more fascinating for me as I learn more. And I really hope that this just sheds some light for anyone that's listening.
So and what is your optimal diet?
So this is something that is a meat fat based diet, and the fat part is very important.
So she talks about the fat part being very important. Why is fat so important? Because I think that's another conditioning in us, is that fat is bad for you. It's bad for your heart. It's going to make you sluggish. It's going to make you fat. Does fat make you fat?
Fat does not make you fat. Sugar makes you fat.
Okay. Sugar. What does fat do, and why is it good for us?
Well, the first thing is that sugar is not a requirement in your diet, because the body needs glucose to operate in certain areas, but you make this sugar on demand. Your liver does it. External sugar is deleterious, in fact. Okay, we have mechanisms to deal with it. There's a huge production of insulin to lower the level of sugar in our blood, and this sugar is stored, is either burnt or as fast as possible, because it's poisoned. These sugar molecules, these glucose molecules, at the end of the day, all carbohydrates end up either as glucose or fructose. Fructose has the metabolic effect of alcohol on the body. So it's a very heavy and problematic substance that shouldn't be overloaded on the body. And glucose is acting like it's a molecule that will attach to many of other molecules in your body, and it's called a phenomenon of glycation, and it creating havoc in the body if it's too much.
So I wonder if there is this resistance by the medical community for the reasons that you mentioned. And I know that you've worked with experts and you've spent a lot of time in Europe, especially working with medical industry people, and you kind of understand that mindset, and that was a big part of the research that you did. which, again, let's hear another clip from Sophia Clemens on this.
And species, you know, Homo sapiens sapiens, you know, and so we're going to have one optimal diet. And I hear a lot of people say, well, you know, it depends on your blood type, which is insane. Obviously, like one protein difference on your red blood cells isn't going to fundamentally change your entire digestive system. And it's not going to change your species either.
So that was Dr. Chafee talking about how there's this mentality, like we talked about earlier, about, you know, different blood types requiring different types of diets and stuff. Do you find this kind of response from the medical industry in general, at least the ones that you sort of had exposure to when you were doing your work and your research when you first started?
Well, classical doctors, let's say educated in the modern system, they don't see it that way. I think they understand that we're all the same, or the same metabolism, etc. But the problem, they're operating into a paradigm, which I share, which is evidence-based medicine. So I'm not going to talk about the merits of Ayurveda or the Chinese medicine, because each of them, they have their viewpoints, and they don't talk to each other. They have, the chakras do not exist in Chinese medicine, you know. But if we settle the discussion on evidence-based medicine, modern doctors, they really understand this, that these ideas of you should have a diet according to your blood type, or these are ideas that were developed by people who are trying to find a niche to, in my opinion, to make money, to find something that is differentiating them from others and be able to sell solutions to people.
That's the most frustrating part, I think, is that, you know, if it's not making money, it's not worth sharing with people. And I think, you know, across the board, I know you have this mindset that health should be free. You know, everybody should get the best out of their health and what's out there for free, and they shouldn't have to pay for any of it. And people, you know, maybe I'm being an extremist, but people need to find other ways to make money, and it shouldn't be through the medical system. So that was Dr. Anthony Chafee, whose clip we heard. Let's just hear a little bit from Sophia Clemens as well.
Of about 100 grams of red meat, average red meat, that is combined with 35 grams of animal fat, pure fat. So this is the basic ratio to start with for everybody.
So 100 grams of red meat with 35 grams of fat. Is that the ratio of the fatty meat that we should be ingesting every day?
Well, as a start, yes. I think it's a good balance. You need this fat for energy, because your body will now run not on sugar, but on ketones, which is a product made by the liver to give energy to your cells. It's a much more efficient fuel for the body. And in my opinion, it's a natural state of the body. If you have sugar in your diet, the body will prioritize sugar in terms of energy, but not because it prefers it. It burns it first because it's too dangerous to keep it in the blood. Yeah, or in it. So
is this every day we eat that much fatty? For me, it's fatty beef and lamb. That's the red meat that I prefer. And I know most people prefer beef over lamb even, which I do too. So is this every day? That's all we eat is fatty red meat until we're healed? And then what happens? Can we introduce other foods once we've sort of, you know, gone into remission or cured and healed ourselves and gotten better?
So I think it is a question of getting in tune with your body. So what I recommend to people is to make a month and a half experiment. Just have fatty beef. I would say 2/3 meat and 1/3 fat, which translates in terms of calories in 80% fat and 20% protein. This is a ratio that everybody can start with. Some people feel better with a little bit more fat. Some people feel better with a little bit less fat. And it all depends also on your strict adherence to the thing, because if you make exceptions, then things get muddied a bit.
Yeah.
So
I noticed that. I think that whenever I deviated over those 6 weeks, I kind of felt like I had to start again. And I did. I started again because you can feel it almost right away. And then I would start my 6 weeks again, like you said, a month and a half.
Yeah. And so after this month and a half of it's a radical elimination diet, which happens to be reconnecting with our true diet, the human diet, right? Now, we are used to a lot of stimulations. We want variety. We have cultures where food and sharing a meal with people is important, and we want more variety. Okay, there's nothing wrong with it, because after a month and a half, you are better able to notice the signals that your body is sending you.
Yes.
So if you reintroduce one food, let's say after a month and a half of meat only and fat and water, I'm really willing to reintroduce cheese. I would do it and wait for 3 days. If nothing happens, if my mental clarity is not impacted, if my digestion is still good, then it's okay.
So basically, after your 6 weeks, after you've really sort of reset your health, hopefully, or you've sort of set off to a better path, then you can, in a measured way, start reintroducing other foods. But primarily, the concept is that you must keep it,
yes,
or ideally keep it animal-based rather than introducing more plants. So less plants, if none at all, which is what I did. I didn't reintroduce any plants.
Yeah. So I can give my example. For 6 years, I've been eating meat and water, and I reintroduced...
And salt to taste,
yes,
you should
and
add.
And salt to taste.
Yes.
It's important for the electrolytes. And, well, in order to get some variety, I reintroduced cheese and yogurt. And this is basically all I eat.
And
but
we do eat eggs and
sometimes, but it's really rare.
And you don't mind milk, so the
dairy, yeah.
Yes,
because I can tolerate it. Some people don't tolerate it, but some people don't tolerate it and will tolerate it after a while. But I mean, it's not a huge part of the diet.
Yeah,
it's just for variety, because we are
right.
We have this habit. But I can go into a fast food restaurant or pizzeria and eat a pizza and eat some salad and everything is okay. I'm not falling down to the ground.
So you're saying as a one-off, once
yes.
in a while, it's okay to have a little bit of fun. And you're right. Food is, for some reason, it's become an entertainment and it's become so social.
Yes. But I want to make clear that as Muslims, we cannot make plants haram, forbidden.
Yeah.
Allah has not made fruits forbidden, for example. He said clearly that everything which is plant-based, outside of fruit, is inferior.
Right.
So if we have a choice, I think it's a disservice to our body to go towards something that is inferior.
Agreed.
Hence the reaction of Sayyidina Musa when he said to them, well, if you really want to eat that, go back to Egypt.
So on that note, let's hear what they have to say about cancer, because, you know, now it's getting serious. Now they're really tackling this subject.
And unfortunately, this is a progressive disease, which means that almost all cancer patients die in the end. It is just the time frame that can make a difference when it comes to low-grade cancer as compared to high-grade cancer. So the trajectory of the disease is always the same. And this is where the PKD may be a game changer, because we can put those patients into a stable state of the disease. So usually what we do see is that with brain cancer, there is a stable disease once they start following the diet properly, which means that there is no increase of the tumor thereafter. And this is already something, because as I said, this is a progressive disease. This is expected to grow, because this is how tumors behave. This is just how it is. So if you can put somebody in a remission, progression-free state, that's already a big thing. And there are other benefits coming from the diet, like controlling epileptic seizures, because sooner or later brain cancers result in recurrent epileptic seizures, and then they need anti-epileptic medications to control this, which most of the case doesn't work, as we know. So then they also have the epileptic seizures to cope, and you can become epilepsy free on the PKD.
I think it's so unbelievable how most of us don't know this. I didn't know this until I met you, Ahmed, and I didn't realize the importance of this knowledge. And I know that over the years, you've really sort of opened the eyes of a lot of friends and family. I know you don't do this professionally, and you wouldn't want to, you know, try to build any kind of a health practice, which I understand everybody should have access to this. But how is it that cancer can be, I mean, she's talking about advanced cases of cancer, and I really recommend everybody go to this podcast and listen to it in its entirety. It's just one gem after another. But how is it that doctors aren't open to this, or even human beings, even people aren't open to understanding this and what it can do to us?
We are, as a species, overcomplicating things, again, with preconceived ideas. And these ideas are being pushed. I think it's not by accident. I think there is consciously pushed because rulers, let's put it that way, have noticed that when humans are nourished with inferior food, and especially plants, they become much more obedient, much less capable of thinking independently.
And dependent on the system,
And basically, they act like cattle.
Wow.
And it's not surprising that from Hollywood to the mainstream media, until very, you know, natural health professionals and gurus, they all push this plant-based because it makes obedient disciples.
And I can see that because, honestly, you get a little bit more foggy in the brain. I don't know what it is. The thinking is not so clear. And now I know the difference because I've sort of seen both sides. And after being on my fatty meat only diet, it's remarkable the kind of clarity and the energy level. I mean, I can keep going on and on about the benefits from, you know, beauty, like, you know, your skin condition and your skin tightens and you get this glow, the body, the figure, everything is just, you know, optimal. But then you also feel really good. And they actually touch on this about the misinformation on meat as well, meat causing cancer.
I don't even call them studies. I mean, they were just, you know, taking pieces of epidemiological, you know, mismatched statistics and sort of cherry picking data and deciding what to put in and massive amounts of confounding factors. And, you know, it's been, you know, reproduced and corrected for those confounders and absolutely no association between red meat and colon cancer. And yet people still cling to this. I hear colorectal surgeons in the hospital still telling their patients, oh, and, you know, watch out for red meat, you know, that will cause colon cancer.
What's your reaction to that?
I think doctors in particular, they gave a lot of years of their life in studying and in practicing, and they just don't keep with the research.
Yeah.
And, I mean, even the American Heart Association is not blaming anymore saturated animal fat for any kind of disease.
Yeah.
There were reviews already 10 years ago, systematic reviews of all the so-called proofs, and there's nothing.
And here they're talking about the challenges just about going against pharma.
About this much, because you cannot go against the whole everything, the whole system, the whole pharmaceuticals. And so what you and I are representing goes against what everybody else is representing and what is in the interest of everybody else.
Yeah.
Wow, it's a mammoth opponent. I mean, how does anybody circumvent that and allow people to just see for themselves what the facts are?
Well, I think we are driven mostly by admiration. So money is one thing, lack of courage, going in against your professors. I mean, doctors are taught really to be very obedient, okay? Things will change when people will be transmitted some information by people they admire, by people they respect.
Yeah, that's one challenge. And the other challenge, as they'll speak about here, is that there's no money in this.
To sell when you tell people just don't eat carbs and sugar. And, you know, so we have to sort of think of something that would make it economically feasible to profit off of this. and then there'll be some money behind it to back it, to push these human trials.
So really, I mean, they seem challenged to, you know, find ways for people to make money from this knowledge so that they can really help people with this genuine approach of something that's actually going to make a difference in their life and in their health.
Yeah. What is a bit amusing is that there is absolutely no money to study humans that are just eating meat or animal products, because obviously what I see and what everybody who has tried it see is a resolution of all, let's say, chronic problems.
Wow, but that's huge.
Yeah, because the body is a self-repairing machine.
Yeah.
And if you provide the nutrition it needs and the energy it needs, it will repair.
And the only reason fatty meat is so good is because it's nutrient dense, right?
Yes,
it gives you everything.
It provides everything you need.
Yeah.
Despite what could
people
be said,
don't know
there
that.
Is absolutely no lack.
Yeah.
Okay. It's like telling a lion that he's missing something because it's eating meat. We have exactly the same digestive system as the wolf or the lion.
So the biggest concern that I got from people is that cholesterol is, you know, a terrible thing. And if they eat too much meat, they're going to have to deal with cholesterol. And their doctors have warned them against cholesterol. And I want to talk to you about this, but let me just hear or share with you what they said.
Just because they stick to the version that they used in the 90s. And since then, it turned out that cholesterol is not harmful. Eating organic is not harmful. You should eat animal fat instead of vegetable oils, and I do not see these components being involved. So they still stick to the version they used before.
Okay, wait, what? Cholesterol is not harmful, and cholesterol, is it then good for you?
Cholesterol has been blamed for all the havoc created by sugar in the body. And actually, we have proof that, for example, the Harvard Medical School have been paid, professors there have been paid by the sugar industry to point the blame to fat.
But that's criminal. So we're being told something is
yes.
bad for us when it's actually good for us.
But
all because there's an interest or an agenda behind it.
Yes, and it has been 20 years that it has been known that this is just fraud. It's not even a mistake. It's a purposeful misdirection of the blame.
Yeah.
All the problems caused by sugar and the increase of sugar for the past 100 years, all the problems created like heart attack, hypertension, all these things, diabetes, they have been put, the blame has been put on saturated fat, the animal fat. Our whole body is made of cholesterol. All our cells, membranes are made of cholesterol.
And
all
we need
our
it.
Endocrine system, all our hormones, etc., are base of cholesterol, vitamin D is cholesterol, etc., etc. So
there's no dangerous level of cholesterol, right?
Not only it's not dangerous, there is a strong association. If you have low cholesterol, mental disease comes up.
Oh my God.
Like Parkinson, yeah. Like Alzheimer. And you can really, you saw people, I mean, once you just look at the statistics without knowing anything, that 50%, you take people who have a heart attack, 50% of them have low cholesterol and 50% have high cholesterol. So how can you blame cholesterol?
I know that recently, especially from family and friends, you've been seeing a lot of autoimmune questions. People are coming up with a lot of autoimmune disorders, some serious conditions like MS. I know that there was a friend recently that you pointed in this direction who had Crohn's disease. You've seen some pretty advanced cases of MS and other really worrying conditions. Just want to play this clip first.
We have seen improvements, neurological improvements too with multiple sclerosis, so gaining back movement, but at least 6 months of strict diet adherence is needed.
Yeah.
So, for example, we have seen a lady who was sitting in a wheelchair for something like 20 years, and after 6 months on the PKD, she was able to stand up just by herself from the wheelchair. So this is a neurological improvement.
We should mention she calls the carnivore diet PKD because they came up with it like 10 years ago when there was really not much talk about carnivore. So that word really wasn't around as much. PKD was what? Paleo?
Ketogenic diet.
Yeah, paleo. Yeah, which is basically meat-based from her definition. And she says that with advanced cases of MS, like that woman who was in a wheelchair for 20 years, it took a good 6 months for them to start seeing the condition reverse. How challenging would that be for an MS patient to have to go through 6 months of fatty meat? Or does it become enjoyable at some point? And do they just start really getting into it?
Well, I think most people find it very enjoyable.
I do.
Meat, it's a whole world on its own, and your taste adapts, and many people don't go back, you know, even for variety. It's not worth the risk.
And not only is it not worth the risk for me, I just didn't really enjoy it. Anytime, you know, you and I have sort of traveled quite a bit, and when we splurge and, you know, I'll go and have whatever, something that's got a plant or
digestion, you know, is really different.
Yes, it really doesn't make me feel so good. And so it's not even appealing to me anymore, which is really quite shocking because I didn't think that I'd be saying that ever. And yet these two talk about how doctors are out of touch, you know, with only touting plant-based and low-fat. Let's take a listen.
Their cardiologist, you know, was, you know, saying something that they had to stop eating meat and they had to go like on a plant-based, low-fat diet. And it really bothered me. I was just like, well, you know, you can tell your cardiologist that they're 10 years behind the literature in their own field.
Do you see any hope? Do you think that people will turn around and really start paying attention to this incredible discovery that I've made and I know you've made many, many years ago?
It's hard to say. I mean, I think it is really an individual journey. I don't think the masses will adopt easily because they follow, again, what is presented to them as leaders.
And
all the leaders, the narrative is, on the contrary, trying to eliminate what is healthy.
And also, there's so many unknowns. A friend of mine recently called me and said, you know, I'm really inspired by you because of what you've experienced from eating just fatty meat, salt, and water. That's what I did for 6 weeks straight. Now, as you pointed out, you know, we've introduced cheese and yogurt and eggs and, you know, more variety, let's say. And she said, but I'm trying to get pregnant. And of course, I would have to stop this during the pregnancy, right? And I think rather than me answering, let's just take a listen to this clip where they actually address that.
I had a friend of mine who had two carnivore pregnancies. Kids are doing amazing. Their development is literally off the charts. And she tried to tell her OBGYN, who's a great guy, who's actually my professor of obstetrics when I was in medical school. A brilliant, brilliant man. And very nice guy. He was very supportive of what she was doing, but he was just like, I'm not too interested in it, but maybe you keep doing what you're doing. And her pediatrician is basically in the same category, but just said, look, you know, whatever you're doing, just keep doing it. And this kid will end up being 6'5" and smart as hell.
So when you're pregnant, it's okay to continue to eat fatty beef and salt and water and pretty much animal-based food?
Well, is the question, is it okay to be on an optimal diet for a human? Of course.
Yes.
You are going the maximum chance and you're allowing your child to express its maximum genetic potential.
So it's actually good for the baby. And what about when the baby is born? Should we continue to feed the baby?
Yeah.
Meat-based?
Well, it will be milk-based.
Yes,
for,
initially.
Let's say 2 years, which is, as far as I know, an animal product for 2 years, right?
Right.
There's no plant in there.
Right.
And this is the way Allah has designed it.
And then after?
And then after, I would go directly to meat.
Wow. See, this is also stuff that they don't...
Because if you take a three-year-old child... Present to this child a piece of plant, like a broccoli, and a piece of raw meat, and see the reaction of the child.
Of course.
The child will immediately jump on the meat and gorge on it.
There's a reason why we all rejected that broccoli when we were kids, and I still did.
Children like vegetables.
Yeah. And what's sad is this isn't even allowed to be made into the studies, and she talks a little bit about those challenges, about trying to get some of this stuff published.
You may have seen that we have case studies where type 1 diabetics have been put into remission, became insulin free, and their own insulin production partly returned, which is a big success, because otherwise it's just trending towards zero and remain zero throughout their whole lives. And in such cases, if we intervene early enough, then the own zen production can be restored. And whenever we did this for the first time, back to 2014-15, it was just impossible to publish it because we got back an email that, okay, you haven't heard about that, type 1 diabetes is incurable.
So over time, I know you've done a lot of research, and I know that you worked with a lot of medical experts. Did anyone else try to publish anything, or was anyone's work taken seriously or embraced by the wider population in the industry?
Well, what you must know is there's absolutely no money and no support, on the contrary, to study this way of eating. Now, I would argue that it's not even needed.
Yeah.
It's not even needed because we have been doing this for the past 2 million years.
Yeah.
Until very recently, when food was, let's say, scarce and there was a famine, we would go to plants, for sure. And the poor people would, you know, eat wheat and corn, etc. But it's because they didn't have access to meat.
And the agriculture of today is so new. It's not the agriculture of the previous generation, or even when they quote the Rasul Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, our prophet, mm-hmm. They say that, oh, he used to eat this and this, but whether he was eating a cucumber or whatnot, that the hadith, and we have to also look into those hadith to see the authenticity, but surely it wasn't the same cucumber as what we have today.
For sure.
Yeah.
And like in all Africa or Middle East, when you have a society that is not suffering from famine, the main food is meat.
Yeah.
And if we have some hadith where it is said that the Prophet was presented some gourd and he ate from it, we have this hadith because people were struck that he would eat from gourd. Because they wouldn't have noticed it if it was the usual thing.
And also whether it was grown in that region, given the climate and the desert conditions.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of questionable items there. And let's finish this clip with their last thought on the interview, or one of their last thoughts.
Somebody else may ask, okay, you are saying strange things. Where's the evidence? Where is your published study?
Right.
You know, and then almost get ashamed that I'm not able to publish anything, but this is all my fault. This is the fault of the publication system, and they are ready to publish anything that is related to a progression of the disease, treatment without a real result, you know, pseudo results, but not a remission, not a recovery. They're happy to publish this, but they do not want to publish anything that is about a full recovery of an incurable disease.
What a catch-22 trap this is. You can't get anything published, and then people that, you know, want to come and attack you or challenge you say, okay, show us something published, but you can't. So she's really in quite a dilemma here. I mean, what do you think? Is this the way it's always going to be? I know that we don't need it if you just try this way of life and you have nothing to lose. But what about those people that demand to see studies?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think the publication system is broken. Even the director of the Lancet, Norton, said, I think he wrote an article 10 years ago saying that you cannot trust anymore what was published in the scientific literature, because most of the experiments published could not be repeated, or it was too tainted by conflicts of interest.
And Dr. Chaffee has actually pointed out a lot of corruption in some of the most reputable medical journals.
Yeah, yeah, we know. The thing is, what Sophia Clements is pointing here is that she has a clinic, she has doctors working on people, they reverse disease. In this case, it was type 1 diabetes, and every doctor will tell you that you cannot cure that. Well, she has a case of a patient that was cured,
yeah.
They documented, etc. It's written.
And so frustrating.
To the level of publication. And the publications refuse to publish it because it's not possible to reverse such a disease.
So that's really
so
frustrating.
So how do you get out of this?
Yeah, exactly.
So I would say studies are interesting, but you can have a study that says the opposite of another one. At the end of the day, it's really how people feel. That should be the measure. We should, If we adopt a meat-based diet, we go along with all human history for the past 2 million years. We are not adding, it's not a fad, it's not a new thing.
Yeah.
I would say it's to people pushing plant to prove that it's not harmful to humans. And what we see is an explosion of problems.
I agree. And because of you, I've learned so much. And thank you. I love you for it, for that and so many other reasons. Thank you for shedding so much light. And we are going to eat fatty meat today for lunch now.
Well, like every day.
Like every day. Okay.